Hey, folks, you're listening to a free version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. You have no idea how much you're missing. Farron Cousins joined me this week for three whole segments. You wouldn't know it because you're only going to listen to one. I had three great interviews this week, a couple of candidates, one from TYT Investigates, all stuff that you need to know. But we got to pay the bills. We got to keep the lights on. We're going to turn on the recording devices, et cetera, et cetera. And the way we do it is by having a membership show. You can have access to all that extra content, and you can keep this show alive. Membership shows are our primary revenue stream, and it's folks like you who make the decision to make it today to go to ROFpodcast.com and sign up to become a member. We're just talking about a little change every day. I don't know, a quarter, 50 cents, 75 cents. I'm not great with math. But nevertheless, for stuff that just jingles in your pocket, you can support this program, and you can do so right now. ROFpodcast.com. Go there, sign up. You'll get not only extra content on this program every week, but you'll also have access to 10 years worth of archives with some amazing guests. Guests that were interviewed by Mike Papantonio, by Bobby Kennedy, and by myself. Check it out. ROFpodcast.com. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, investigative reporter Ken Klippenstein will join us to discuss documents he uncovered that detail a Trump administration plan named Iron Fist that targets black identity extremists. We'll talk with Phil Arbayo, a California congressional candidate, about Devin Nunes and a bizarre lawsuit to sue fake Twitter accounts. Ring of Fire Online contributor Farron Cousins is here to help me run down all the headlines you may have missed this week. And our candidate spotlight this week will be with Mondaire Jones, a progressive running for Congress in New York's 17th District. If you're listening to the radio right now, you should know that there's a free one-hour version of our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever podcasts are found. There's also a member show, and you can support Ring of Fire by becoming a member and getting our three-hour radio program without commercials with total access to 10 years of our archives. You can go to ROFpodcast.com to sign up. Help me run down a busy week in the news. Farron Cousins, executive editor of the Trial Lawyer magazine. So, Farron, thanks for joining me. And let's dive right into this week. The week started off with largely the same theme that the Trump administration has been pursuing in one form or another since the day that Donald Trump rode down the escalator to announce his candidacy in 2015, which is an assault on immigrants, not necessarily undocumented immigrants, but all immigrants, and really maybe not necessarily on all immigrants, on immigrants who are from non-European countries. Like the president said, countries like Norway. I'm trying to bring out the theme here. From countries that are not primarily, or these immigrants who are not primarily considered white. And Donald Trump did that in the form of sending Ken Cuccinelli out there. There has been on the books, as you know, really for 150 years or so, a law about public charge that if you are an immigrant coming into this country or are in this country and are looking for a pathway to citizenship or permanent residence here because maybe you have family or you're getting married or something to that, that you need to prove that you will not become a public charge. One of the ways in which you could do that, and one of the way that it's been working basically since the mid-90s, public charge is a pretty vague, becoming a public charge is a pretty vague sort of assessment, right? And one of the ways that you would prove that you would not become a public charge is that you would have your soon-to-be husband or your soon-to-be wife or your parents who live here, basically, or your cousins, or you would find a sponsor that says, I am the guarantor, I'm making a contract with the U.S. government that this person will not become a public charge. And that has been quite effective. We don't have particularly high rates of immigrants who come here, try and get on, an track to permanent residency or citizenship, who end up needing much by way of government services. It's certainly less than the number of people that it would make it likely that these people would become public charges. And that is what the law says, likely. And how you determine that now has been expanded to include a whole host of things that really have nothing to do with that. And so this is just an assault on the 500,000 immigrants who are seeking permanent residence. They're here legally, but they're seeking a more permanent situation. And this is Trump playing to his base, right, Farron?
It absolutely is. And what it does really, though, is it helps destroy, if they accepted reality, it would help destroy one of the biggest talking points that Republicans have been saying for 2 years, which is, no, we just want the illegal people out. Legal people, you're fine, you can stay, you can come in, just do it the correct way. I mean, that we've heard that so many times, and now they're saying, okay, well, we're going to tweak the laws a little bit, so even if you want to come in legally, it's going to be a lot harder to do that, unless, of course, you can prove that you're never, ever going to need any kind of public assistance. Basically, as you pointed out, we want the Norway people. We want well-to-do people coming in that don't look like somebody who's going to cause trouble. We know exactly what all of this means. You know, Cuccinelli spelled it out for us very clearly when he described, what he wants on the bottom of the Statue of Liberty now. They're not even masking it anymore. And again, they came for the illegal immigrants. They've done a horrible job with those people. And, you know, we saw that with the raids that have taken place. And now they're going after the legal immigrants, too. And this is exactly what a lot of us said. There's always a progression. It's always going to get worse. And here it is, laid bare this week.
And I would add that they're not just going after those who are literally in line to immigrate here, right? Those who are doing this in a legal process. A lot of these people, when they file for things like food stamps, Medicaid, Obamacare, they're doing so on behalf of their children who are U.S. citizens. And now that Cuccinelli, who is, let's be clear on his job, he is in charge of benefits for immigrants. And he is now weaponizing that. So if a father who is here as, let's say, on a green card or a resident or not a citizen is filing on behalf of his children who are citizens, there is a lot of indication, a lot of anecdote data, not the same as data. It's a little bit early to tell, but anecdotally, there is a belief in within and without the government that people are basically failing to apply and seek the help that they are legally entitled to because they're afraid. And so they're actually going after, in many respects, American citizens who may be the children of immigrants who are either documented or undocumented by denying them services that they are legally entitled to. And this is a problem because when we talk about what these services are, their nutrition support, their things like health care. So this is the program here, the project, the Stephen Miller project, is not, like you say, limited to undocumented immigrants. It is not limited to legal immigrants. It is largely an assault on this entire community, regardless of their immigration status and or their citizenship, for that matter. And so, you know, this is where when people talk about the idea of how immigration plays into things like white supremacy and plays into a prejudice, this is what we're talking about.
Well, you know, the other thing, too, and you mentioned this, was he's doing this to appease his base. We know this. We've known this. The question is, does it work this time?
Right.
Obviously, 2015, 2016, when he's running on this platform, the economy was recovering. It was not statistically as good as it is today, even though I know we're going to talk about that hopefully later, that it's really not as good as it seems. But nonetheless, you did have people who were suffering. They needed someone to blame. Trump gave them someone to blame. Now, is it going to work? Because kind of the gig is up a little bit. I mean, aside from the hardcore Ann Coulter, let's kick them all out people, average American citizens agree that immigrants coming into this country is a net good.
Yep.
You know, the photos and videos that we saw last week from Mississippi, those are going to be in textbooks, in history books, you know, in probably just a few years,
Barron,
about this dark time.
Let's take a quick break. We'll talk a little bit more about this. We'll talk about Donald Trump's assaults on other parts of our government as well. We're going to take a quick break. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back with Farron Cousins after this. Hey, folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he has been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar, here with Ring of Fire YouTube contributor Farron Cousins. So, Farron, when we broke, we were talking about the Trump gambit at this point, and we're going to probably circle back around to this in the last hour when we start talking a little bit about the campaign and what's happening with the economy and what that could mean for Trump's reelection times. But we're talking about, obviously, Stephen Miller has been pursuing this since day one of this administration, which is to continually squeeze not just the requirements to seek asylum in this country, which they have done, not just squeeze the amount of people who are coming in via asylum laws, not just squeeze people out who we hear under a long-term temporary assistance program because they had a civil war in their country. They had some type of massive natural disaster. A lot of those people have been deported. He also has been wanting to attack legal immigration, and they are there. They are there now. We have legal immigrants who are in this country. They're on, temporary visas. They're on extended visas. They want permanent residency. They want citizenship. And now this new interpretation of an existing statute that's been around for, I don't know, 160 some odd years. And we should say it's also reflective of some harsh realities about America. Right. But this new interpretation of this statute is meant to separate families, is meant to deny legal residents full immigration rights in this country. And the question we landed on at the end is this going to help? And I think you're right. I mean, I think that it's quite possible. I mean, we're certainly seeing the polling that is rejecting this type of assault on immigrants. But, you know, there was a there's a book out there called Identity Crisis, which talks about how the existence of Barack Obama, a black president, began to polarize a huge swaths of the voting population along the questions of race. And with the election of Donald Trump, a similar thing happened on the left and center left. And that is that people's opinions about immigration became polarized along these same lines. So where Barack Obama could get away with not nearly as harsh and vindictive and cruel, frankly, policies regarding immigration, still to some extent were harsh and cruel at the very least, and were in some instances record-breaking when we're talking about deportation. And so the odd thing is that a lot of those people now see immigration in a vastly different light. And your point, I think, is well taken. I don't think that this is going to be necessarily successful. They're clearly not running a strategy to win the whole electorate. They're trying to, you know, they're getting very narrowly tailored. But I think largely a lot of people reject this type of harsh anti-immigration policies.
Well, we've seen reports over the last year and a half or so, you know, a lot of anecdotal evidence, a small business owner here, a small one there, but they all kind of say the same thing. And they say, listen, this administration is cracking down not just on illegal immigration, on the temporary work visas. Yeah. And my lawn business depends on this. You know, my restaurant on the beach, it depends on this. And when they see this crackdown, and many of these people say, well, I had voted for Trump, but now I can't get my workers, I'm closing my doors. And they also at the same time see, well, wait a minute, Mar-a-Lago just got 72 temporary visas and hired, I think last season was what, one or two
right
Americans, and then the rest were all the temporary visa. No, the con is being exposed and has been exposed. And I don't know that this is going to have the same effect in 2020 as it did in 2016, especially when you consider the fact that at the time, and again, things are getting worse for people and they're probably going to get much worse in the near future, but they know now who is to blame.
Right.
Trump can't go there and hoodwink them and say, listen, you lost your job because this man came across the border and took it, and I'm going to give you your job back. Now it's going to be, we lost our jobs because you've gone into some kind of weird trade war that you don't know what you're doing. And you did that on your own, Mr. President. You can't blame that on the guy from across the border. You can't say it's because an immigrant came over here and had to get on food stamps. That's not true. We know this because we lived it firsthand. So he's going to have a lot harder time selling that to the public this time around. Some will buy it, obviously. They always do.
Right.
But not enough this time, I don't think.
And I think that's a good point. And we also have to imagine, right, that there was a certain percentage of people who either underestimated the harshness and the cruelty involved in his plans in regards to immigrants and immigration, regardless of whether it's undocumented or with documents. But there also have to be a certain percentage of those people who said, like, you know, Paul Ryan will take it. We'll temper him, or Mitch McConnell will temper him. And I think we've seen that that's actually not the case. But there's a lot of people out there who I think, you know, may have come to that conclusion. Now we're gonna wait and see. I am always cautiously optimistic. And in the meantime, we're creating all sorts of just completely unnecessary and unjustifiable suffering on the part of people, and creating anxiety. And it is really a continues, I guess, a rolling sad week for the country. But Farron, we've got to take a quick break. We'll be if you'll join me in the next hour, that would be great. Meantime, we'll be right back with more Ring of Fire Radio. Coming up, uncovered documents from the Trump administration detail a plan to target so-called black identity extremists. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio.
I remember I was singing about September when you walked across the boardwalk to that smoky bar. And I've been singing for the last 6 nights and I couldn't bear to talk to tell you just how pretty you were. But you were as pretty as a preacher's wife on Sunday. I was useless like a church bell on a Friday night. And I felt like a tragedy all dressed in dirt and clothes.
Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop. Hey, folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he has been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America.
Fraud.
Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Last week, our next guest wrote an article about leaked documents from the FBI that detailed the priorities of the organization under the Trump administration. Here to explain what was discovered in those documents, investigative journalist Ken Klippenstein from TYT. So, Ken, you have done some pretty important reporting here for the Young Turks Network, and these are documents that have been obtained by you folks. They were marked law enforcement sensitive and for official use only. These are FBI documents. First off, let's just start with this. Like, what are these documents? What exactly are they in just an institutional form? And then let's talk about what's in them.
So these documents were produced by FBI headquarters, and they include the counterterror priorities. Each year they release a formal document that is the result of extensive planning, discussion, and decision-making to kind of set forth what are the major, usually the list is about 12, around maybe 15 priorities long each year. And they sort of decide not just what they're going to focus on, but also what they're going to focus their resources, you know, manpower and intelligence gathering, attention, things like that, too. And so for this counterterror priorities list, I got their priorities list from fiscal year 2020, 2019, and 2018. So it gives you a really nice sort of snapshot of what the Bureau's priorities under President Trump have been. And it had been reported previously that one of their priorities was, quote, black identity extremists. And that's really what piqued my interest in this, because when that was reported, that obviously, you know, triggered a great deal of concern, but there wasn't a whole lot known about the context in which this black identity extremist priority was conceived. And so what these documents show is what exactly their intelligence gathering around black identity extremists were, where that group as a priority stands in relation to other counterterror priorities.
Right.
And just, you know, general context, which was missing prior to the story.
So we should, you know, I mean, so just so that people can understand, I mean, this, I imagine the FBI has been doing this for quite a while. And they produce this document every year, and they must get somewhat granular as you know, if we're talking about 15 sort of like institutionalized counterterrorism threats. I mean, what constitutes terrorism in there in, you know, is that part of this document, or is that just simply a principle that exists within the counterterrorism division of the FBI, or what?
It's not defined in these documents, but within the intelligence community, the sort of general definition for it is violence undertaken for sort of political goals or political purposes generally. So that's sort of the umbrella definition that the intelligence community uses.
That's interesting. And you know, when I hear stuff like this, I harken back to during the Bush administration years where at one point radical vegans were put on this list because a list similar, I guess, because they had been protesting out in front of a honey baked ham factory. And there was some talk that maybe they could, I don't know, do something violent because of this, because they were radical vegans. But this black identity politics, like what extremists, like what? I'm not even sure I understand what that means. What does that mean, black identity extremism?
Well, it seemed like until, you know, these documents, nobody had a really detailed understanding of what that was. But according to documents, and what's astonishing to me is that they specifically cite the Ferguson protests following the killing of Michael Brown by, you know, a law enforcement officer, Darren Wilson. They specifically cite that as the genesis of the quote-unquote black identity extremists. So I was surprised that they would draw that connection to, you know, protest movements that were overwhelmingly peaceful. And not just that they would do that, but that they would put that into a document that very well could get leaked and they, you know, might have to face political consequences in it. And that did happen, of course. So I was a bit surprised that they – because ordinarily with these documents, these are wide distribution within the Bureau. And of course, since these are law enforcement sensitive, they're not given to the public. But I mean, a lot of FBI, you know, agents and analysts see these things. So it's not like it's a compartmented program that only a few people have access to. They had to know that a large number of people were going to see this. So I was a bit surprised that they chose that language, because if you look at how they defined white supremacists, which is another counterterror priority, they don't cite, any protest movements as their genesis. So I found that concerning.
Let's tease this out. Now, at what point, when we talk about the Ferguson protests, we're talking about events that predated the Trump administration, right? And you only have documents from 18, 19, and 20. So presumably they're written in 17, 18, and 19, those documents, right? I mean, they're doing it for the next coming year, I guess. I mean, you tell me if I'm wrong. But so do we have a sense of whether that this is not a function of the Trump administration, or is it? I mean, because what they're talking about, it sounds to me, is like the Black Lives Matter movement. It seems like this is a euphemism.
Yeah. And I'm sorry, but there's so many pages I can't recall. But I think they mentioned Black Lives Matter as well, as I recall. And I would, you know, encourage listeners to click through the documents. I embed that in the PDF, but certainly if you read the context that they provide citing Ferguson, that is absolutely the impression that one gets. I don't see how someone could read these documents and not get that impression.
But is there, and then the other question, so we don't know when this designation materialized. We only know right now, because we only have the documents from 18, 19, 20, that it is spoken in relation to Ferguson, but we don't know that if this was a new designation that occurred contemporaneously with the Ferguson protests, shortly after the Ferguson protests, or if this designation cropped up in 2018.
That's correct. You know, a big part of the problem is they don't release these things. And actually, before the ACLU and other nonprofits had tried to, you know, file Freedom of Information Act requests and even litigated them, and the Bureau refused to produce them. So it's very hard for us to get insight into what preceded it. But I would not be surprised if this was not actually something that happened under Obama, for the simple reason that when Black Identity Extremists, the term, was first reported in foreign policy, I believe in either 2017 or early 2018, it precipitated a, you know, big controversy, and that sort of culminated in Senate Democrats speaking to, you know, in a formal Senate hearing, the FBI director, who assured them that he had gotten rid of that designation. And what these documents show is that the constituent parts of that designation, the definition, the criteria that they use to, you know, describe what Black Identity Extremists are, they just moved that under a new term, and they kept basically all of those constituent parts. So while what the FBI director was telling the Senate was narrowly true, that they technically, yes, they changed the formal name that you would see on the one-page list of priorities, if you actually click on the priority and look at what constitutes that, it's all the same stuff. So,
okay,
it's hard.
Let me see if I can just understand what you're saying. So in 2017, there were Democrats who were upset at their awareness of a term being used. Was it Black Identity Extremists? Was the term at the time?
The Congress had brought this up a number of times, but this culminated just last month, like weeks before I got this, in the Senate having a formal hearing where they just kind of say, why are we doing this? All these white supremacist attacks are happening. And it was Cory Booker. You know, there's video. You can see parts of this. And, you know, you have the FBI just telling them straight up, yep, we got rid of it. It's not there anymore. And that just seems incredibly disingenuous.
Okay, I see. So the complaints came very recently. They got rid of the term Black Identity Extremist. And you're saying that they came up with a different one? Or what was the one that they supposedly got rid of? And they just recreated the category under a different name.
Yep. So now they have a new term. It's called racially motivated extremists. But then within that, they end up conflating white supremacists and the Black Identity Extremists. So they just put the new thing under a kind of neutral sounding term, but it's the same thing. And, you know, in my view, to put that alongside a counterterror threat that has actually killed a bunch of people,
well,
you know, recently.
Yeah, let's take a break here, okay? Because now, because we need to move on from the, well, let's talk about the legitimacy of actually having the what we're talking about is this even, never mind the term, is this a legitimate category and one that you can actually put on the same list as a category that seems to be literally far more dangerous. But let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk more with Ken Klippenstein about this piece that he has written for the Young Turks about these leaked FBI documents revealing the Bureau's priorities under Donald Trump. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America. Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking with investigative journalist Ken Klippenstein about his piece on TYT Investigates.
Leaked FBI documents reveal Bureau's priorities under Trump. So, Ken, before the break in the last segment, you had basically walked us through what you found. You have obtained leaked documents. These are internal FBI documents, counterterrorism documents, where they outline the potential threats that they see in the coming years ahead. You have documents from that outline the threats in 2018, in 2019, in 2020. One of these threats, before this document was leaked, was known to be a category called black identity extremists. That seems to be a euphemism for Black Lives Matter. That came out of the Ferguson protests. A month ago, they were questioned by members of Congress about this, and they, the head of the FBI said, we've gotten rid of that designation. But it turns out that these documents that you show say that they actually haven't gotten rid of the designation. They have just genericized the term to racially motivated extremist groups or something to that effect. And they have lumped it in with white supremacists. And so, I mean, I think most people have a vague awareness, but can you tell me the number of terror attacks, domestic terror attacks, however you want to determine it, that have been perpetrated that could even be remotely related to this notion of black identity extremism, whatever that means, versus the ones that are explicitly white supremacists? And we know they're explicitly white supremacists, not just by the nature of who they've attacked, but in many cases, there have been some, you know, screeds or at least a trail online. Like, I'm trying to think of the time where we have a white church shot up, or where we have, you know, white shoppers shot up by a black person, a black identity extremist.
Well, the FBI actually had problems finding examples, too, because if you look at their definitions of, you know, the two components of racially motivated extremists, for the, you know, black identity extremists, they don't cite a single example. And then you go over to the white supremacist one, and they have, if I recall, half a dozen. So it's not just, you know, us that it seems difficult to find cases. The FBI themselves couldn't, at least according to these documents.
So that's stunning. So they, I mean, do they have other threats that they've listed up there that are, I mean, that's a hypothetical threat, right? I mean, if you can't point to a single example of violence coming from a some kind of supposed domestic terror movement, you're just talking about something completely hypothetical, right? I mean, they could easily have just put in there, like, you know, frothing radio hosts who seem to have a problem with the American way of life. I mean, that could be in there. There'd be just as much evidence that, you know, people like me represent a threat, a domestic terror threat.
Yeah, I think it's extremely concerning. And what's odd is that they actually assert that there has been, you know, violence, political violence perpetrated on the part of black identity extremists, but they don't cite any examples. They just assert it. And then when you go to the white supremacist portion, you know, they cite extensively all of these different cases. So it appears that they believe that it's happening, but at least according to the documents, they don't mention it.
Now, can you see on this documents that are there references to other domestic terror threats that seem to be, you know, as far-fetched as this? I mean, I guess the real problem is that they're lumping it in with a real threat, as in white supremacy, right? I mean, I guess my point is this, is that I can contemplate the idea that the FBI would and probably should, you know, present hypothetical threats, right? Like, it's conceivable that you know, we're getting some sense that all of these radio hosts are banding together, and you know, maybe we're picking up chatter that they're talking about buying weapons or whatever it is. And I could see that you would put that in, like, we have a category of threats, hypothetical threats, we call them, where there's, you know, it's not a real threat, but it could potentially be a threat. I mean, how do they break these down, or is it just numbered? And to the extent that it's numbered, like, how do you put as a tie between white supremacists who have killed, you know, I mean, tens of people, scores of people at this point in the past several years versus another group that hasn't seemed to have even injured anybody, that hasn't done anything, that we can't even point to anybody who would be a member of this domestic terror movement.
Yeah, well, they organize them by what's called, I think it's called threat bans. And so, racially motivated violent extremism, as they call it, that's at the very top. That's in the, you know, topmost band. And what I thought was a little shocking was, it's in the same band as ISIS. And beneath it, threats that are considered, less of a counterterror concern are Al-Qaeda and basically all of its affiliates, Al-Shabaab, Al-Qaeda and Arabian Peninsula. So, again, it's difficult because we don't know now that they've collapsed white supremacists and black identity extremists in the same term. They could say, oh, well, actually, we're taking the, white supremacy threat very seriously. But we don't know because they don't.
So here's the bottom. Here's the bottom line is that what we're looking at is not just their assessment of threats, but we're looking at the plan on how they're going to expend their resources. And Now they can come in from it and tell Congress, yes, we are. Are you handling the white supremacist domestic terror threat seriously? Yes, we are. We're expending a lot of money on racially motivated violence. And they could literally be talking about, oh, we have people spying on the leadership of Black Lives Matter.
Right. And I want to add one more thing. One of the most incredible things to me was they actually, it's not apples to apples. They don't, because I know people are going to, look at this and say, oh, well, why not just put the different races into one thing so that you don't treat them discreetly or whatever. And, on its face, that might seem to make sense, but they don't actually define black identity extremists and white supremacists in a sort of apples to apples fashion. They describe black identity as the word suggests. And if you look at the documents, they stress a notion of like a separate black, homeland and personhood. And it's all about how they conceive of their personhood. And then when they describe white supremacists, they don't notion of one's personal identity. That's not how they define it. They define it more in much different terms. And so I would encourage people to look at that gulf between how they're
the point being that the threshold to call someone a black identity extremist is much lower than it would be to call someone a white supremacist.
I believe so. Yes.
Well, this is a fascinating work, and people should check it out. We will people should check out your work here. Ken Klippenstein, piece is entitled Leaked FBI Documents Reveal Bureau's Priorities Under Trump for TYT. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Sam.
Ken Klippenstein writes for the Young Turks, investigates, and specializes in Freedom of Information Act requests. When we come back, Farron Cousins will join me to analyze more news from the past week. It's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Check out ROFpodcast.com to support the show. Hey, folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he has been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com.